From KUAR News in Little Rock, this is a look at this week in news, politics, and more. The big story this week:
Arkansas lawmakers hold and finish a special session. We'll discuss what was approved in one rather contentious item.
A federal appeals court rejects Arkansas's 12-week abortion ban. We'll have reaction.
Central Arkansas Water strongly objects to a government settlement with ExxonMobil over the 2013 rupture of its Pegasus pipeline.
The State Board of Education takes a step toward dividing the Pulaski County School District.
The Quapaw Tribe pushes back against objections to efforts to get a special designation for a piece of land.
And we'll talk with NPR's Steve Inskeep about his new book looking at Native Americans being forced to move west in the 1830s and Arkansas's connection to that.
All that's coming up next. It's been a busy week. Joining me in the studio to talk about this is KUAR's Jacob Kaufman.
Hello.
Chris Hickey.
How's it going?
And morning anchor Sarah Weitz-Kotacek.
Hi, Michael.
So, Jacob, this week the legislature met for a special session, the first time that Governor Asa Hutchinson has called a session. You covered that this week. What were the key issues?
Right. Well, the major issue for this special session, the real reason for it being called at all, was to provide an $87 million state incentive package to Lockheed Martin. And the idea behind that is that state investment in Lockheed Martin would help that company upgrade its facilities down in Camden in South Arkansas. And the hope is that that contribution from the state can bolster a bid from Lockheed Martin to try to get a federal defense contract to manufacture around 55,000 of the next generation of Humvee-like vehicles. That bid still has to be approved by the Department of Defense, but this is Arkansas's foray into that. So that was the biggest issue that really came about this time.
And there was some controversy, or at least some conservatives expressed concerns that this isn't necessarily the role that government should be taking.
Right. And the real, I guess, schism in the conservative mind over this is they like the idea of having an unfettered free market that doesn't have any state involvement, whether that be through incentives to a company like Lockheed Martin to deregulate, to detax, things like that. But this is clearly the state investing state dollars to create jobs. And you'll hear over and over again, the government can't create jobs. And this is an instance where if you listen to Governor Asa Hutchinson, who addressed lawmakers on the steps of the Capitol the first morning of the session, he commented on that.
The fact is, we'd all like to be purists. In which there is not any government involvement in high-stakes super projects. But the fact is we've got a competitive environment with other states. Other states in various ways are supporting these super projects. Arkansas has been on the losing end of many of those competitions, and we want to compete. And so this is where you set aside pure economic theory and say, let's be practical. Let's compete.
That argument certainly was very persuasive in the end. Two-thirds majorities in both chambers just about passed this. There's virtually no opposition at all. I think there was two or three votes throughout the entire time that all came from the Senate in opposition to this. So that was clearly an argument that won people over.
But, of course, it's uncertain right now. Lockheed Martin still has to win this bid or win this contract. At least two other companies are vying for this. But if it does, what would be some of the benefits to that South Arkansas region?
Sure. The most immediate gains, and this is what the state is really looking at and promising through an independent consultant, that they would add 600 jobs to an existing facility in Camden while preserving the 500 that are already there. So that's the immediate, about 1,100 jobs they could say are going to Ouachita and Calhoun counties in South Arkansas. And Arkansas would also enter into a 25-year agreement with Lockheed Martin. And Asa Hutchinson really touts that as a pretty long business deal, 25 years to ensure those jobs are there. And the bigger argument, and not just those 1,100 jobs, is that there'll be a spillover effect, that industries that supply Lockheed Martin that use similar things, so there'll be additional jobs in the area, that kind of ancillary development would bring more money. And these jobs are fairly high paying. They're $58,000, $57,000 a year. So people say that'll definitely – the payroll will benefit that particular part of the state. And in the long run, by the time this 20-year bond issue of $87 million to support Lockheed Martin is done, the state will estimate at least see some return of that money. So it is a good investment for that as well. And the other thing, though, is there might be some future orders from other people, not from other military actors besides the United States. But when U.S. Senator Tom Cotton joined Asa Hutchinson on the Capitol steps to kind of promote this project, and Tom Cotton is, of course, a military veteran, he really picked it as not just a good state investment financially, but a very sound patriotic investment.
I think that it'll be the first of many new projects that we can bring to South Arkansas, where the workers are not just skilled, but they are also very patriotic. And they always keep in mind that their end user, their customer, is the warfighter on the front lines trying to keep our country safe.
And while that is certainly true that the end user for this immediate contract is to make 55,000 of these Humvee-like vehicles, these have a lot of armor plating. You'll remember during the Iraq War, the soldiers would frequently complain that Humvees couldn't protect them from roadside bombs and things like this. So this is an answer to those kind of challenges. But Lockheed Martin executives afterward, if you'd ask them, they didn't really necessarily bring this to the forefront of their own accord. They would say there are other potential customers for this military hardware.
There will be foreign customers. They are not included as part of the assessment because of the magnitude of that. We don't know yet. I'll let Scott answer that.
Yeah, I mean, we fully expect that, you know, that there'll be foreign governments that will want the same capability as the U.S. government from a tactical wheeled vehicle standpoint.
And those are two Lockheed Martin executives that have some familiarity with the existing plant in Camden. The last one speaking was Scott Green, a vice president at the company. And that raises questions of Arkansas tax dollars in some way, in some indirect way, will possibly end up subsidizing military gear for some foreign government, possibly a country like Saudi Arabia. And that is something definitely a lot of state legislators are a little uneasy with.
Now, Jacob, that was, of course, the big reason that the governor cited in calling this session. But another big issue was moving the state's presidential primary date. Mm-hmm. And initially it was proposed that this would be a permanent change, but it ended up only being set for next year. Explain a little the debate that went on here.
Right. And all this is over. And they ended up moving all of the primaries, the state level primaries and the presidential primary, from late May to early March. And the proponents of this, which were about two-thirds of both chambers again in this instance. So even though this was the most contentious, still clear support in the state legislature for this. The idea is that if you move Arkansas to early March, then all of a sudden it's going to be the fifth or the sixth state in the presidential primary process instead of one of the last ones. And so advocates of this, mostly Republicans, say this will make Arkansas more relevant. It'll make different presidential campaigns come to the state that might have avoided it before just simply because the primary season's over by late May. And it's, and more than that, it's grouping Arkansas in a so-called SEC primary that's a block of southern states. And so GOP advocates are really hoping this will kind of raise the profile of the South in trying to determine these things. But the big objection from Democrats is, and some GOP people, is that the move unfairly favors incumbents. They'll have to push back the fiscal session. And there's some speculation it might just be to help the former governor, Mike Huckabee, to give him an early win, kind of bolster his process. And so that's what's going on. And there's a lot of rigmarole in both sides in terms of parliamentary procedure to try to halt this. But in the end, they got it through on the third day of the 3-day session.
And Democratic Representative Greg Letting of Fayetteville told you in the hallway that or at least what he thinks the real motive behind this was.
I think you've got, what is it, 19, 20, 21 Republicans running for president right now. And obviously, if our primary is up earlier and more of those individuals need to pay the $25,000 filing fee to be on the ballot, that's quite a haul for our Republican friends. And I'm quite certain that if there were 20 candidates on the Democratic side, the DPA would be pushing for this too. So I don't think it's a partisan issue.
Right. And to Letting's point, in the House, the House State Agencies Committee, the committee that was in charge of all of this, the Republican chairman, Nate Bell, was a fierce opponent of this. He tried some maneuvers himself to try to get this delayed. So if they're going to move it, do some study about it first to see if it really will increase voter turnout, to see whether holding a primary in March when there's a lot of icy storms, whether that's something they should worry about, and really trying to look at the ramifications of what it means when you make candidates for state office have to file over a year in advance, have to campaign 50% as long. So there's a lot of different changes to that. And bill backers, despite some concerns in backing this amendment where it only happened once just for the 2016 primary, and that's something they had to do to get it out of committee because it was stuck in a Democratic committee 4-4 on multiple votes. So they had to do this amendment for it to only be one single election cycle. But a bill sponsor, Republican Representative Andy Davis, he spoke to me after the final vote about what that amendment means to him.
It is what it is at this point. I expect that we'll see higher voter engagement due to the fact that they're playing a more prominent role in a national election. And if we see those things, then I think we can make a stronger argument for making a permanent change.
And it was also Andy Davis's birthday, so it was a good way for him to end the session. He got a big bill passed that had a lot of frustration on both sides. But I think the bigger fallout for this, besides the primary, if you just look at the process of what that institution, the state legislature, looks like, is that people are in the minority, people like Nate Bell, a handful of Republicans, and some Democrats, particularly in that Senate committee that forced this amendment through. They really feel like that their role in the minority, where they do have some power in committee that is put in there through the rules, was really ignored by the will of the majority. Because to get this bill through, they had to pull bills out of committee by suspending the rules. They had to suspend the rules on both chambers to make these kind of changes. So people feel like the voice of the minority and the power of the minority was kind of ignored a little bit through some of this development this week.
And Chris, you covered the signing ceremony on Friday with Governor Hutchinson. He pretty much got everything he wanted through. I assume he must have seemed pleased.
Yeah, he seemed very pleased. And many of the legislators who were there were also pleased. The governor noted how there was pretty much unanimous support for all pieces of legislation by the time it reached his desk. And he was in good spirits, for sure.
And one goal that he had for this session that he had told me on Monday was that he wanted it to be quick. And he got that, finished up in 3 days.
Yeah, started Tuesday and ended Thursday.
And Jacob, finally, there were a few other items here, including the merging of several state agencies. Talk a little bit about the rationale behind that.
Sure, I'll talk a little bit about it, although if you'll notice, not many people talk much about those things with that that bond and that primary election taking up a lot of the air and media's attention. But they did. They merged four state agencies into four other ones, and that's supposed to save around $10 million over the course of 5 years. Governor Hutchinson has said all along that he believes to really put Arkansas on track in terms of accountability and fiscal savings, it takes a lot of small little steps like that. And Hutchinson, he'll say this was a very compassionate way to merge the agencies. He never said explicitly that anyone was going to get fired necessarily. There were some people that were shifted to the agencies they were moved to. But the main focus is not filling jobs that have become vacant through attrition and just not filling some of those vacant spots. And so there's the change to the merger of the state agencies. And there's a change to the DWI law that saved about $50 million for the state. It was just a technical change that had to comply with a federal court ruling if Arkansas wanted to keep getting that money. So there were a few other changes. And one few mile stretch of highway for a yet to be built highway to Jonesboro would allow some agriculture equipment like tractors to travel on it as they have been for decades. But that would they have to get an exemption from the federal officials for that.
Well, another big story this week came from the 8th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. And this got some national attention. Sarah, the court struck down parts of a law passed 2 years ago by the legislature, which would ban most abortions after the 12th week of pregnancy. It's one of the most restrictive laws in the nation, and other states have taken similar approaches. So this is getting a lot of attention from other states as well. This concerned what's considered the point of viability for a fetus. Can you explain a little what the court ruled here?
Well, Michael, the point of viability is the point at which a fetus can be reasonably expected to live on its own outside the womb. And for about 40 years now, the U.S. Supreme Court has established that that occurs at 24 to 25 weeks of pregnancy. So the Federal Appeals Court upheld Arkansas federal judge's ruling from last year, striking down portions of this, what was called the heartbeat bill, which required doctors to check fetal heartbeats every time they perform an abortion, and also restricted abortions to 12 weeks in cases of rape, incest, or fetal disorder. So that was a significant departure from the Supreme Court standard. And, you know, I spoke to State Senator Jason Raper, Republican at the Capitol, yesterday, and he told me that preventing abortion is a calling for him and that he would like to see the Attorney General Leslie Rutledge appeal decision once again and take this back to the full 8th Circuit Appeals Court. As of right now, three members of that court have reviewed the appeal and made this decision. So he thinks that the former Attorney General, Dustin McDaniel, you know, a Democrat, that he defended this law when it was challenged by the ACLU and the National Center for Reproductive Rights, along with two area doctors. But he thought that the Attorney General could have brought more scientific evidence forward showing that, in fact, new information is coming to light revealing that actually this point of viability happens much earlier.
The three-judge panel said viability is definitely moving. The science has proven that viability is much earlier than it used to be, and it encouraged legislatures to provide more information and evidence.
And Jason Rapert was the sponsor of this bill 2 years ago, so he certainly has a lot of interest in this. Other groups who advocates for abortion rights, what did they have to say?
Well, I spoke with Rita Sklar, the director of the ACLU of Arkansas, and she told me there's just no way that a fetus could be viable before this 24-month period. And she really doesn't think there's any more evidence to bring before the court, and that, you know, this has been costly for the state so far, in her view, having to pay the lawyer's fees of the various advocacy groups that have fought against it. So she just thought that this case doesn't have a chance.
A 12-week ban amounts to a total abortion ban. And the Supreme Court has spoken up loud and clear that women have a constitutional right to have an abortion up to the point of viability.
According to State Senator Rapert, the Attorney General is considering an appeal, and he's in discussion with the AG's office about moving that forward.
And Jacob, where do you think this goes from here?
Well, it's hard to say. I'm going to backtrack for a second first. It is interesting. You mentioned this was passed back in 2013, that originally there was a 20-week abortion ban that came out of that session. And then Jason Rapert upped the ante a little bit, moving it up to 12 weeks. And while both of those bills have been going through court this last session, the pro-life movement has chosen a different tactic. Instead of going about looking at the point of viability and cutoff in weeks, they kind of worked around the edges and did some other things, like trying to require that abortion providers have access to area hospitals and have 48-hour mandated wait periods and forced to have a certain amount of consultation with therapists and things like that. So that is interesting. And so I imagine from here, they're going to go back next session and go back and work on that weak argument again. So now that these things are clear in the court, they're probably going to try again. And even though the court might have said that, and Governor Beebe and legal scholars at the time said this is going to cost the state money, we're going to lose in court ultimately, Jason Rapert and people like the Family Council and Jerry Cox that represent some of the conservative Christian right in the state that really do have a lot of seats in the legislature, pretty influential. Governor Hutchinson tends to agree with them on a lot of things. They've continuously said, whether you think this is unconstitutional or not, based on some sitting judge, that the way that liberals, they would say, got abortion to be legal, and what their mission is to continually push the needle forward in the courts to make them continually readdress this. And they think in some way, if they don't try to bring these legal challenges constantly, even if they are maybe dubious on current legal grounds, that they're really giving up on the battle, and they need to keep the pressure on by doing these court battles.
Yeah, I guess continue to try and chip away at the abortion rights.
Right. And fundamentally, what Sarah was saying, I think, is right, that it's Jason Rapert would like to have some arguments about the point of viability, but ultimately it's about protecting what he views as fully equivalent living human beings.
The Attorney General's office said that they're reviewing this matter. They're considering whether or not to pursue an appeal, and it's not clear whether that will go forward, but they're thinking about their options.
Okay, well, another story this week. The head of Central Arkansas Water, Chris, expressed concern over an agreement that was reached last week by the state and federal government with ExxonMobil Pipeline Company over the rupture of the company's Pegasus pipeline 2 years ago, spilled more than 200,000 gallons of oil in the community of Mayflower. Under the consent decree, ExxonMobil is agreeing to pay $1 million in state penalties, as well as almost $300,000 in legal fees and $3 million in federal fines. But, Chris, what's the concern here from Central Arkansas Water?
Well, under the public comment period that was established after the consent decree was announced, the public had a chance to express concerns. And one of the driving concerns of Central Arkansas Water, which oversees the water supply for about 400,000 people in Central Arkansas, is that the pipeline, which is over 70 years old, was built in the late 40s, runs through the watershed for the main source of drinking water for pretty much everyone in this region. And their basic point is this consent decree does nothing to address that. It keeps the pipeline in place as is. It doesn't replace any section of it. It doesn't require the company to ExxonMobil to move the pipeline out of the watershed or any other stream or river that feeds into any other watershed that provides drinking water to any part of the state. In addition to that, they highlighted three provisions in the consent decree, which I should mention was agreed to by the U.S. Justice Department on behalf of the Environmental Protection Agency, the Arkansas Attorney General, Leslie Rutledge, on behalf of the Arkansas Department of Environmental Quality and ExxonMobil. So Central Arkansas Water sent these comments this week, highlighting three provisions that they termed unacceptable. The first of those was a provision to basically make sure that Exxon treats its segment of pipeline that they would characterize as susceptible, quote unquote, to longitudinal seam failure. If we remember, the rupture in Mayflower was the result of a longitudinal seam failure. It was a kind of a split along the path of the pipeline, probably about 20 feet long. Mm-hmm. Basically, the consent decree requires ExxonMobil to meet the federal regulations that are already in place. Now, the problem with that, as CAW pointed out, was that, well, ExxonMobil had done testing on the pipeline in 1991 and 2006, and they determined then that section of the pipeline was susceptible to longitudinal seam failure, and nothing was done about it. They point out that it's a violation of federal law and PHMSA regulations, the Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration. But the law wasn't enforced. And if that's the case, they point out, CAW points out, you know, how can we expect this to be, you know, matter in the future? How can we expect this provision to make any difference if there were another failure of that sort?
They should have been treating it as susceptible to seam failure since 1991 and maybe only as late as 2006. But still, they should have been treating it as susceptible to seam failure for some time. So that section of the consent decree is only restating what should already be going on. Again, it's nothing new.
You also spoke with a representative of ExxonMobil. How did they respond?
They responded kind of in a brief and, you know, formal fashion, just saying that they've been cooperative throughout the process. They were there and took responsibility after the spill happened, and they've been working with federal officials and local officials in addressing the issue. But they wouldn't really, I mean, I spoke with a spokesman for the company, and he wouldn't really comment on any specific concerns that were highlighted in the letter.
Yeah, and the company does have some legal issues still pending. There are lawsuits that are related to this, and but the company, you know, says these things happen sometimes, and that pipelines are the safest form of moving oil across the country. Jacob?
Yeah, I think that's important to remember that while this agreement might be going to the consent decree, where the state of Arkansas or the federal government will get some amount of money to help pay for their efforts in cleaning this up and for violating fines, the people whose lives were affected the most, perhaps the residents of Mayflower, when 200,000 odd gallons of oil about in March 2013 went through a few neighborhoods, some through their waterways into part of Lake Conway, they're still all entered in civil suits. I think most of those homes, if not all of them, have been bought by ExxonMobil at this point, but they're still having claims of health effects, long-term health effect damage, and almost all these people say they're having trouble even getting someone in Arkansas, a doctor who would have any experience treating kind of oil exposure and those kind of things. So those are ongoing, but I like Chris's point. I think this is one of the most powerful points that people are holding on to at Central Arkansas Water and local authorities, is that the nature of this pipeline, because it's so old, because it's from the 40s, they used a welding technology that the federal regulatory agency, he says over and over again in official documents, is susceptible to the very type of longitudinal seam tear that happened. And so if that's the case, then it's not one section near Mayflower or one section near the Lake Maumelle watershed, but it's literally hundreds of miles of pipeline from Texas through Arkansas to Illinois that has this type of weld that is simply outdated, and it's a type of technology you would never see used in something like Keystone, which is very contentious in its own right, but it's certainly much more advanced than what's going on right now in central Arkansas. And on Arkansas Week, earlier on ATN, we were talking beforehand just about the context of droughts in general in the country right now. You see California's having constant water problems. Georgia and Atlanta did a few years ago. And this is a pipeline that goes through central Arkansas's best watershed, largest watershed, and it really brings a lot of questions about the idea of democracy and what a local community can really do to say, this is our drinking water, this is how we want to handle it. Because at this point, what Central Arkansas Water thinks is best for the drinking water is only a small part of what actually gets to happen around that watershed.
And we should note also that the Pegasus pipeline is turned off right now. It is empty, so mm-hmm. it can't affect the watershed at this point. And one of the other points that John Tynan of the of CAW said, and is highlighted in their public comment to the Justice Department, is that one of the stipulations is that ExxonMobil will be required to train some of its employees who would be first responders to an oil spill on the pipeline in the year 2015 and again in 2017. John Tynan pointed out that, well, it's unlikely that the Pegasus pipeline is going to be reopened in that span of time. So it's kind of, they claim that it's kind of pointless to be training first responders when the pipeline's not even going to be active. And again, another provision that they object to is the consent decree requires ExxonMobil establish 3 caches, kind of, you know, location storage facilities, of equipment and supplies that first responders can use in addressing a potential oil spill if one were to occur in the future. 2 of those are in Texas, one is near Dallas, and the other would be in Mayflower. And again, he pointed out that, well, you know, the pipeline runs through hundreds of miles through Arkansas. Mayflower is not the only potential site where a rupture could occur. So,
yeah, a lot of people don't even know. And in the case in Mayflower, there were a lot of homeowners who didn't even know that pipeline was there, even though it was pointed out it was within documents when they bought their homes. But it's a lot of stuff that people don't always even notice.
Right. And if I may add on, CAW proposed about 13 additional provisions to the consent decree that they hope would be included eventually, although that remains to be seen. In addition to removing the pipeline from the Maumelle watershed, they'd like ExxonMobil to train local first responders, state and county emergency officials who were the first ones there, you know, after it happened in March 2013 in Mayflower. And they also want the pipeline or the company to perform spike hydro testing on the pipeline to ensure that it can handle pressure of oil and various other things. I mean, the list goes on.
And we'll be hearing a lot more about this. This battle will continue. On to the topic of education. Sarah, plans are moving forward for the cities of Sherwood and Maumelle to leave the Pulaski County Special School District and create their own districts. This week you watched a meeting of the Arkansas State Board of Education, which approved a report making that recommendation. But I understand, Sarah, that Superintendent Jerry Guess has some concerns.
Right. Superintendent Jerry Guess pointed out that the boundaries of the Pulaski County Special School District were established historically to incorporate a diverse range of people and to share sort of the burden and benefits of being in a public school system that, you know, allows for an equal education of various demographic regions. So there are intense pockets of racial and wealth disparities in this region, and certain towns have been advocating to separate from the PCSSD. And the State Board of Education has held a series of meetings, about five since it decided in January to review the boundaries of the district, and superintendents from the various towns have spoken about their interests. And the State Board has written this report recommending that the PCSSD be divided into five separate school districts. So one would be south of the Arkansas River. That'd be the Little Rock School District. And then the four north would be Jacksonville, Sherwood, Maumelle, and North Little Rock. So this actually can't happen until the PCSSD gains unitary status. It's also subject to a desegregation lawsuit that dates back to 1989. And it has to improve in five areas in order to gain that status. So that's facilities, student achievement, monitoring, discipline, and staffing. And recently, Pulaski County voters decided not to approve a millage that would have funded facilities improvements for the district. And that was an overwhelming vote against the millage. So some are seeing this as a vote of no confidence in the PCSSD, but the district really needs that money to address facilities in order to start to gain unitary status one step at a time. And that was Superintendent Jerry Guess's priority. And he's hoping to bring another millage vote back to voters, you know, rebuild relationships and improve the image of the district. So this plan is sort of like a proposal for the point at which law will allow the separation of the districts. And, you know, the concern of Superintendent Guess is that the poor towns will be left behind. Their tax base won't be able to support the same kind of education that students could get in a wealthier place like Maumelle or Sherwood.
At some point, the line for the school district boundary was created based on some objective criteria, and that's what it became. Today, I understand those parents wanting to change that, but today you still deal with the issue of what is fair to one person may not be fair to another.
And, you know, on the other end of the spectrum, State Board member Diane Zook and business interests are concerned about keeping students in the public schools and attracting students to strengthen the schools. So they want to strengthen the areas that already have a lot going for them and allow them to have that discretion to separate and take care of their own, so to speak.
I'm concerned about kids staying in public schools. Mm-hmm. I'm concerned about parents feeling that they have, choices. I think when our schools become the best, that people will come and that will reflect the community and the diversity within those communities.
The Jacksonville district did separate from the PCSSD by popular vote in November, and apparently there have been some unexpected complications with that separation, but that district is still subject to the same requirements that the larger district is for gaining unitary status. And the PCSSD is nearing the end of its five-year term under the supervision of the State Board of Education. As to when it will achieve unitary status under the desegregation case, it's really unclear how long that will take given the severity of the needs and as these five areas in which it has to improve. But what the State Board is doing is, while it has supervision of the PCSSD, finalizing a report to give a roadmap for the future of the district in the long term. And it will review this report again at the end of June to approve it.
Jacob?
Yeah, I was just wondering, Sarah, if you've heard anything from the existing school districts like Little Rock School District, North Little Rock School District, in terms of, do they want to pick up the remnants or the scraps, I guess is the kind of the mean word to use, from the Pulaski County School District? I guess at Little Rock at this point, since they don't have a school board necessarily, and State Board of Education in a way already is determined their fate. But do you have any idea what if existing school districts want to pick up the rest of the Pulaski School District?
Well, I think this could be advantageous for the Little Rock School District. As it stands, the city of Little Rock itself is divided between the Little Rock School District and the Pulaski County Special School District. So advocates of the LRSD would like to see that the entire city unified in one local school district, which might be called the South Pulaski School District, Little Rock School District.
It's hard to imagine they could have a more complicated name than PCSSD.
Well, we'll see what happens with that next meeting scheduled for June 21st. Jacob, also at the Capitol this week, the leader of the Quapaw tribe of Native Americans was there to talk with some lawmakers. And this concerns the ongoing fight for the tribe to obtain a federal designation for a piece of land near the port of Little Rock. What was he saying?
Sure. It's kind of odd at first because Quapaw Chairman John Berry went to visit the Legislative Black Caucus at the Capitol, and it was on the first day of the special session. So he came out to see Tom Cotton and Governor Hutchinson in an armored military vehicle, but that was just kind of coincidental for his part. But the Quapaw are formerly of Arkansas. They moved to the Arkansas in like the mid-1500s or something like that. So they're one of Arkansas's first indigenous people. And they were forced out by the military in the 1830s, in part to clear the way for statehood. And now the Quapaw that are residing in Oklahoma, they've purchased 160 acres of land along the Arkansas River, right in the middle of Little Rock's port, at least their long-term plans. The port doesn't own the property at this point. And the Quapaw purchased the land. They say they found ancestral remains from a time when there was a brief reservation in Little Rock for them when they were moved from the southeast part of the state to central Arkansas. And there's also – the reason he visited the Black Caucus is because there are also some slave burial sites because it's a former site of a plantation. So he's trying to build some bonds with the African-American community. And the Quapaw say that they bought this land to sort of as a return to Arkansas. This is the first piece of land, I believe, they own in Arkansas right now, and they've owned it 100-plus years. And so that's exciting for them in one regard. They want to maintain the burial sites, a cultural site. Right now there's some farming on it. They plan to continue the farming. But the fear from the port, the fear from the Pulaski County Judge, Barry Hyde, and Little Rock's mayor has been that, well, if the Quapaw get this federal trust status, that they're no longer subject to local or state rules. They have a lot of autonomy, and that's the federal government has some areas for Indian nations to still have autonomy in the United States, that they could build a casino if they wanted. And so there's Arkansas, of course, does not allow casinos. We have two quasi casinos that the state approves in Oakland and Southland, up in northeast Arkansas. And both those have animal racing attached to them, is why they're kind of allowed. But the port is really concerned because it's a multi-million-dollar industry. The river has billions of dollars of traffic on it, and this is part of their long-term growth where this land is. And they're worried that the Quapaw could build something on there that doesn't conform to the long-term needs of the port, like so they want to build rail through there eventually, things like that. And so basically the Quapaw chair, John Berry, was calling out the mayor and the county judge, saying that they're fear-mongering. He said, saying we're going to build a casino borders on racism. And of course he asserted, hey, this was our land first. It's kind of odd in the first place that you're telling me what to do with it.
Yeah. Well, what could the Black Caucus do?
Well, the Black Caucus, a lot of them – a good percentage of state representatives from Little Rock that are African Americans, and some of them that represent this particular area of land. Their districts represent this land. And so his hope is that he can, as he would say, a lot of community leaders are fear-mongering about this, so they're certainly not necessarily his ally in trying to get this federal trust status. The mayor and the county judge have sent letters to the federal government telling them to not approve it because of the importance of the port. So he's hoping that because of the slave burial site and just because of the role that's happened, where historical experience of African Americans being a minority, being their concerns not really listened to, that these are sort of natural allies in this debate to preserve the land and to allow them to have this trust status. And I'm sure he's assuring them that we're going to protect the slave burial sites.
Why don't we hear a little bit of what John Berry had to say?
Sure.
First of all, it's odd that we have to come back and purchase land that we were kicked off of. And second, we're just trying to do the right thing. And there's a lot of fear-mongering put into this process that's unnecessary. And we think it's motivated by people who don't really care about who we are and what we're trying to do. They're just trying to protect their own monopolies. My ancestors are buried there, and so are the ancestors of the African-American community down there. And we think their lives have meaning, and we think it's our responsibility to do everything we can. And using this law that's specific for this purpose is what we should do. And we're just exercising our rights. We're not creating any new law. We're not trying to bend the rules. We're just following the law.
Any idea when any kind of action could happen? Is there any timeline here for the federal government to take some kind of action?
Yeah, and the chairman came at the just after the close of the comment period for this federal trust application, and that's when the mayor and the county judge and the port stepped in and sent their letters out to the federal government telling the Bureau of Indian Affairs in Nashville, telling them not to approve the trust status. But in August is when we should hear back, and John Barry is very confident. He says, we're not bending the rules. This is the law. The law was made for us to do this.
Well, on the topic of Native Americans, it really is considered one of the darkest periods of American history, the forced relocation of Native American tribes, which began with the Indian Removal Act of 1830 and what's come to be known as the Trail of Tears. I spoke this week with Steve Inskeep, co-host of NPR's Morning Edition, about a new book he's written, which came out this month, focusing on the two key players. The book is called Jacksonland, President Andrew Jackson, Chief John Ross, and a Great American Land Grab. That's the title. And I spoke with him about his new book.
Honored to be here. Thanks very much.
So before we dig into this, Steve, I just wanted to help you visualize this. About 100 feet in front of the KUAR studios here at the University of Arkansas at Little Rock is Asher Avenue, which back in the 1830s was part of the old Southwest Trail used by the Choctaw and Chickasaw tribes.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, there are many other trails also in the state that were used to cross from the east toward what's become Oklahoma. And, of course, the Arkansas River was a key way that Native Americans were transported. So a lot of Arkansans are familiar with the overall story. But I think your book will be fascinating for many as it digs into two key personalities. First, the title of your book. What is Jacksonland?
Well, Jacksonland is the name that I give to land that Andrew Jackson obtained from Indian nations in the southern U.S. through war and treaties and a variety of other means. It's part or most or even all of about half a dozen states, states like Alabama, Mississippi, Florida, Tennessee, Kentucky, Georgia, North Carolina. It is a lot of land. It's enough to form a country in and of itself, and it's what we now think of as the heart of the Deep South, and it's just vital to American culture and history. And if I can mention, I'm delighted to hear that you're so close to that avenue, which was part of the removal trail for some of those Indian nations. I think of Little Rock also because of John Ross, my main character, who was a Cherokee chief and Andrew Jackson's cleverest opponent. His wife is believed to have died in Arkansas. John Ross left by boat, left the Cherokee Nation and the Southern Appalachians by boat, down the Tennessee River, down a little bit of the Ohio River, down the Mississippi, up the Arkansas. And although there have been conflicting stories over the years, the best available scholarship is that she died on that boat and was buried in Little Rock, if I'm not mistaken. And so you have a very close connection to the end of this story. And what I investigated was the backstory, the beginning, the 20 years or more that led up to the Trail of Tears.
Yeah. Well, why don't you back up and tell us a little about John Ross and how he came to be a leader of the Cherokees.
Well, he's a fascinating character and, to me, a very modern character because he was a man of mixed race. He actually had, if you wanted to slice it up, more white blood than Cherokee blood, although he was accepted as Cherokee by Cherokees who traced ancestry through the mother's side, and he had a Cherokee mother and a Cherokee grandmother and a Cherokee great-grandmother, and so he was accepted as Cherokee. But he had a white father, a Scottish trader, and grandfather, and ancestors going back that way from Scotland. These were Scottish traders who'd come in colonial times to live among the Cherokees, married Cherokee women. John Ross was born in 1790, just as the United States had begun, and at a time when the Cherokee Nation was still regarded legally as an independent nation, although Americans had a notion that they should be dominant over that area, and they were about to sign a peace treaty in which it would be finally accepted, firmly accepted, and permanently accepted that the Cherokees were under the protection of the federal government. And so this guy comes of age in a period of change. Cherokees were coming to terms with this tidal wave of white settlement. It was almost like, as I write, that they were like immigrants to a new country, except the new country was coming to them. And they tried to assimilate. They changed their clothing styles. They changed their architecture. They changed their agriculture. They changed their way of doing business. They picked up the white habit of owning slaves. John Ross, in fact, did this because he was a businessman. And you have people trying to fit in while also trying to maintain their own distinct identity. That was their struggle. It's a really modern struggle that's very recognizable in this America that's changing very rapidly and where we have so many different kinds of people. And it's what John Ross was trying to deal with. That was the river he was trying to navigate.
And you're right that Andrew Jackson and Ross were originally allies. Tell me how they first came in contact with each
other. Oh, absolutely, because the Cherokees decided that they would support the government of the United States. And in the War of 1812, there was a regiment of soldiers, several hundred troops raised, that was called the Cherokee Regiment, which became part of an army commanded by General Andrew Jackson. And the Cherokees fought under Jackson. Cherokees, including John Ross, fought under Jackson at one of Jackson's great military victories, the Battle of Horseshoe Bend, when the army defeated Creek Red Stick rebels. These were rebels who had risen up against their own Creek leaders and against the government of the United States in what is now Alabama. They'd hold themselves up behind a wall they'd built in a loop of a river, a horseshoe-shaped loop of a river, which we now call Horseshoe Bend, and they fought it out there, and the Cherokees went around behind them, went into their lines, caused chaos and confusion, and then Jackson's white soldiers charged the wall. And it was a bloody, devastating, devastating battle and a total victory for Jackson's side. So John Ross and Andrew Jackson were on the same side, but their interests were not the same because Ross wanted to be included in the United States and Jackson wanted the Cherokees' land to be included in the United States, but he thought it would be best for all concerned if the Cherokees were to move someplace else. He argued that that was not only good for white settlers who'd get the real estate, but that it would be better for Cherokees who were slowly being destroyed by their contact with white civilization, and the idea was maybe they'd do better off elsewhere.
And we then had the Indian Removal Act of 1830. How key a role did Jackson play in this?
I don't think that this is quite so widely realized, although historians know it. This was Jackson's first big idea. He was elected president in 1828, and the main platform that he had was elect Andrew Jackson. He felt that the election of 1824 had been stolen from him and that democracy and honor demanded that he win in 1828. But he didn't have a lot of political programs or platforms laid out. Presidential candidates did not campaign at that time. So it wasn't entirely clear to the public what he intended to do. But his close advisor, Martin Van Buren, later wrote that his first big idea, his first priority, was the removal of Indians from the southern United States to some territory west of the Mississippi. And it, in fact, was the first thing Jackson got to work on in a serious way and the first major legislative proposal he sent to Congress. And that proposal became what you referred to as the Indian Removal Act. It did not compel Native Americans to move. There was no legal basis to do that. But it encouraged them to move voluntarily, in quotes. It said it would provide funding for their transportation and offer them land in the West, and it created a mechanism, a basis for Indians to move, after which emissaries were sent to the tribes to try to get them to negotiate treaties to agree to leave. And of course, as you must know very well, those were not very fair treaty negotiations. They involved coercion, they involved bribes, and when things fell apart, they could also involve force.
Some did agree to go, but you write about how John Ross was an educated man, wasn't easily intimidated, and was willing to fight this effort at a time when many of his fellow tribal members weren't.
Yeah, if one adjective is used to describe John Ross, it's stubborn. Because he held out for so long, more than 20 years, I find him to be stubborn, but also to be very smart and creative and thoughtful and innovative in his use of democratic tools to fight back. He seemed to understand, although I don't know that he phrased it exactly this way ever, that he was an actor in a democratic debate, and he needed to influence that debate, and he used democratic tools to do that. The Cherokees started a newspaper, and their articles were sent across the United States and reprinted in other papers. So you had the Cherokees' own point of view getting out there. The Cherokees gained allies, which they needed to do because there were few of them and they didn't have the vote in federal elections. And so they gained white allies who fought and supported for them and very nearly defeated the Indian Removal Act. It was a very close vote in the House of Representatives. They even got women on their side who petitioned Congress. Even though women didn't have the vote, they petitioned Congress to respect the rights of Native Americans. This was a huge controversy at the time, and the people who protested against Indian removal, although they lost this battle, they went on to fight other battles. Some of the same people went on to advocate against slavery, for example.
And you write that Ross was even willing to take this before the U.S. Supreme Court.
Yeah, and in this way, he is something of a prefigurement of civil rights leaders of the 20th century. Just as civil rights leaders used the Supreme Court to extend their rights in cases like Brown versus Board of Education, and of course we'd go through quite a few rulings, the Cherokees went to the Supreme Court twice. They went to Chief Justice John Marshall, who had let it be known privately that he was sympathetic to their cause. Marshall ruled against them once, and then ruled in favor of them once, and found in a case called Worcester versus Georgia that the Cherokees had the right to govern themselves and their land, that the state of Georgia did not have the right to impose racist laws that would have the effect of throwing them out of the countryside. And although Marshall ruled in this way, Andrew Jackson, who was president at the time, disagreed with the ruling, let it be known publicly that he did not like it whatsoever. The Georgians ignored the ruling, and ultimately Jackson found some political machinations to make it go away.
And what eventually became of John Ross and the tribe?
Well, John Ross moved west. We mentioned his wife dying in Little Rock, or being buried in Little Rock, apparently having died on a boat on the Arkansas River or a little bit further downstream. So he moved west. He remained the chief of the Cherokee Nation for decades longer. It's kind of amazing to think of the long career that he had. He was born in a time when George Washington was still alive. He was a rising Cherokee leader by shortly after the War of 1812. He was their principal chief from 1828 onward, and he was still their principal chief at the time of his death in 1866. John Ross is a historic figure who factors in the Civil War as well as a lot of other episodes. It's a pretty incredible, varied life that this man had, and also impressive that he simply survived so long, because it was such a difficult and divisive period, and there were bitter divides within the Cherokee Nation itself, and many people who despised John Ross as well as loved and admired John Ross, but he hung on until his death.
That's NPR's Steve Inskeep, who is author of a new book out this month called Jackson Land, President Andrew Jackson, Chief John Ross, and a Great American Land Grab. Steve, thanks very much for your time.
It was fun. Thank you.
And with that, we are done with this, the first edition of a Week in Review podcast from KUAR News. I'm Michael Hiplin.
I'm Jacob Kaufman.
I'm Chris Hickey.
And I'm Sarah Weitz-Kotajek.
We hope to be back with you next week for another edition. You can find us online at KUAR.org. Thanks for listening. This is KUAR.